C4. Number 21A.
Now, we come to the 12th chapter, the chapter on Christian Science practice. And within the matrix, we see that this chapter takes the place value of Christianity as science. Meaning what? That we have to do Christianity with the realm of idea. From the point of view of science, to have a scientific understanding, which means that healing is a question of scientifically understand the ideas of God. If we do that, then this understanding has a healing effect. So we get a scientific way of practice, and we see that therefore that the healing practice must be based on a good understanding of the seven synonymous terms and see what the characteristics of those seven synonymous terms are, and through the spiritual scientific understanding of this idea we can heal. We know that disease is always the outcome of mortal mind. Therefore, the outcome of a false system of reference, of a human system, mortal system of reference. It's the outcome of a human calculus and humanly reckoning. Therefore, not reckoning on the basis of the divine system of reference. Therefore, what can counteract this is that we have a divine calculus, divine scientific understanding of the ideas. But what is that understanding that heals? Is it just an understanding where I sit somewhere in a corner and think about reality, or is there more involved in it? And this chapter tells us that there is much more involved in it than just contemplate some ideas and hope that these ideas will do something. That Christian Science practice really takes a whole man. It's something that does not just happen in his mentality, but his whole life, his whole attitude is involved in it. When we ask ourselves, now what is this science of healing? Science, the horizontal of healing of ideas, the vertical. What is this science of healing? Then we can see that we should find a principle lying behind it. And not just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of different rules that we can use. That would be metaphysical healing. Metaphysical healing has its hundreds and thousands of rules, statements which you repeat and which one goes over and over, which one concentrates on. But if it is a science, then we really should look out for that one underlying principle of healing, one underlying principle that would take care or would be the principle for all the various cases of healing. It is different, say, than in medicine. In medicine, as far as I know, there are now 3,000 different diseases that are known and classified, and they have 30,000 different drugs at the present moment registered for these 3,000 diseases. For each disease, therefore, in the average 10 drugs. And you can see that each disease has its own analysis and therefore its own remedy. Not so in the science of being, where there is one principle, and that one principle unites all ideas, as we have seen in the chapter right before, that all ideas must hinge together into one whole. Therefore, we should learn here not some hundred rules, but the underlying one principle. The chapter that is rather big really shows us that underlying principle. And I think it's right to point out here that Mr. Dorley, in his talks in 1950, gave us the layout of this chapter, and I follow his layout exactly. It's not my layout, and I'm grateful that he has done that work on this chapter, which is really giving us a terrific insight. The problem is that he wrote then, on the basis of these talks, a book, a very voluminous book, with about 450 pages or something like that. And it is a book that did sell very well. Actually, it is the book that sold best from his books, because everybody seems to be interested in healing and felt that this book would give them an indication for treatment, for the method of treatment. Actually, when speaking and discussing this book with those who have read it, one is quite astonished to see that very few, if any, have really seen the underlying structure, the underlying principle, and have much more been impressed by the single individual case of healing that he is telling, much more impressed by the way he shows that the Bible and in Jesus' healings and illustrations, he can interpret it so that it is a help for healing. But that was not his aim, though he wanted to show the practicality of the principle. He really wanted to show the principle of healing and also to show the method of healing, the one method, the one principle. So, as that book is available to everybody, everybody can read it and can get a lot of inspiration out of those individual cases. What I want to do is to give, so to say, the structure, the backbone of that book, and just try to show you an overall picture, an overall structure on which you can always fall back in every case. I would like to ask first, what is involved in a treatment? And if we see what is involved in every treatment, then we are asking about the fundamental categories of a treatment, of any treatment. I'm always interested to see the principle and not the individual case. And if we ask ourselves what is involved in treatment, I think we could say, well, in a treatment is involved, first of all, a practitioner. And involved in it is also a patient. If a practitioner is involved, what does that mean? It means that the practitioner must be considered. What does he do when he gives a treatment? Well, we know that his treatment is not giving out a remedy. What he gives out is really the remedy of truth, namely to know the truth. That is his remedy, that he knows the truth about the case. Therefore, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. So we would have to investigate what kind of truth should he know fundamentally. So we have already the practitioner as what he is. Further, what he is knowing when he is knowing the truth. And also we have to know when he is knowing the truth, what kind of method does he use when he gives that treatment. Then we know that this treatment should have an effect on the patient. So, fundamentally, we have the practitioner and the patient, and on the chart that you have in front of you, you have these two great categories. First, the category of the practitioner, And then after the two vertical lines at the end, on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, you have the category of the patient. Within the category of the practitioner, we have therefore three subcategories on your chart. The three subcategories, namely, what constitutes a practitioner, what the practitioner himself has to be. Is a practitioner just somebody who has not made a go of his human job and in his business career and then didn't know anything else but to try out if he can make a living with practice? Or what is a practitioner? Or so that we have to investigate the nature of a practitioner. Then the second subcolumn is the truth he knows. Is that something that is individual, or is there a principle about it? Do we find some fundamental truth about what he has to know? And then the third subcategory, which you have under the practitioner, is the method he has to use. So can you see what those columns want to show? You have the column of the practitioner as what he is, the practitioner as what he has to know as the truth, and the practitioner's method. Then, in the last column, the patient, how he reacts to the practitioner's treatment. If we have those four columns, then we can say, well, let's look at each one of those four columns from the point of view of our seven synonymous terms. All those seven synonymous terms must have their respective characteristic in each one of the columns and show us something about the nature of the practitioner's treatment and its effect. If you think about the first column, namely what the practitioner himself must be, then naturally we could see that we ask that the practitioner himself should somehow have a mentality, a mind of perfection. Therefore, John Dolley was depicting that column there. He didn't put it in the columns as I did them, but his first part, which is our first column, his first part, he depicted as love and mind, meaning that the practitioner has to go out from the point of perfection, love, and within that point of perfection, he has to have a mentality that is of perfection. Mentality is mind. He must have that mind which goes out from love, from completeness, from perfection. If the practitioner doesn't have that mentality himself, how can he give perfection? Out of imperfection, no perfection could flow. Therefore, the practitioner's own status is that he must see that he himself is working on himself mainly, so as to be more and more in line with love's mentality, with love's mind, love and mind. If we keep that pedal note, namely love's mentality or the mentality of perfection, love, so to say, knowing only its own perfection, love, knowing, love, mind, knowing is mind, knowing its own perfection, then we can depict, so to say, the practitioner. Therefore, if we look now at this very proposition from the seven synonymous term, each of those seven synonymous terms would have to give a picture of the perfection of one's own mental attitude. Love, mind. Mental attitude is mind. Do you hear the tone? What is, therefore, and we can reason it out ourselves if we try to do it. What is love's standard of mental attitude when we look out from mind, the first synonymous term? Then we would say, well, wouldn't you say that therefore it is that the practitioner, from the point of view of love, of perfection, would have to see with his own mind, with the mind of Christ, within his mind, would have to see his mind, vision, to see the perfection everywhere. Seeing everywhere, mind, seeing all mind, what love's perfection being brought out. Mrs. Eddy would explain that very nicely with that incident of the Mary Magdalene who came to her as a sinner, and they tried to convince him that she is a sinner, and he said, "Thy sins are forgiven thee." He couldn't see her as a sinful person. He just could see in his mentality the perfection of men. He didn't accept any imperfection where? In his mentality. And could also perceive, therefore, could also perceive in the Magdalene not only her sinful traits of character, but also her desire, mind, her longing mind, to be freed from her character. So the practitioner's attitude would draw that to him in a patient which is there in a positive way. He didn't draw to him those who didn't want to be free, who didn't desire to be free, who didn't long to be freed, who didn't have that mental inward attitude to get free from sin. But the Magdalene had that and showed that attitude by her acts, by washing his feet and anointing those feet with oil, with costly oil, giving everything really what she had within herself and saying, this idea is worth everything. This idea is the pearl without price, love and mind. Well, let's just see how what the mentality of the practitioner is. Here, therefore, that vision, that mental picture, which cannot see imperfection. It's quite different than asking the patient first, what have you been doing? What have you done wrong? Why have you done it wrong? How bad you are? You know, putting really the patient through the third degree first to find out what the big sinner he has been and what he has done wrong and how bad he has been, and then graciously say, well, I will help you. It is the attitude that just didn't ask those questions. A Christian Scientist and practitioner shouldn't try to compete with the therapeutics, huh? With the psychotherapeutics. Not at all. Let that be their job, and they know it better than we do it. Much better. Our job is different. We don't have to dig in the mortal mind and dig out everything in the mortal mind. Let the divine mind rule and the divine mind strengthen all that in the patient that needs to be strengthened in a spiritual way. And that will take care of the situation. That is only possible if we go out from love and mind. If we have really only love's perfection in mind, then we can see in every case the perfection. Let's look at it from the point of view of spirit. What would we see what the practitioner himself, we analyze now the practitioner and see what is a right practitioner. And we would see, I guess, from the point of view of spirit, something that has to do with the ideas characterize spirit and characterize men at the same time. We would say, well, he himself must have a great sense of purity of mind, of goodness within himself, Without that, if he has an evil mind, if he tries to do evil, well, then he can't help the others. Then he will be just a mesmerist and work with willpower. But a Christian scientist, from the point of view of spirit, will have to see that he gains greater purity and greater purity. And with purity is meant spiritual purity. In the first place, spiritual purity, where he does not try to mix up the spiritual science with something else. So here Mrs. Eddy would say that the practitioner must be good and pure himself, and only then, you see, can we also recognize in the patient the good in the patient. Without that purity, we'll never see that little remnant of good which is in every patient. We come to soul, and in soul we would have to see from the point of view of soul what constitutes love and mind, a mentality of perfection. Soul would say, well, what could we say in soul? Huh? That they themselves have to be sinless, that they themselves have to first find their true identity and recognize them as their true identity. Then if we are free from sin ourselves, then we are also able to free the patient of his sins and of self. We cannot give to a patient anything which we do not have. So it's no good to try to, to give the impression as if one would be something which one isn't, because in practice it shows itself. The quality and the nature of a synonymous term is that which heals and not what we show up. If we go to principle, we see something else, something very fundamental. Namely, in principle, we see that Mrs. Eddy shows that the practitioner must forgive himself first before he can forgive the other, that he must win his own pardon first, and then only can he practice scientifically. What does that mean, to win first one's own pardon? Why is that principle? What has that to do with a terrific spiritual power? Because she says, only if we win our own pardon first, we can heal scientifically. Why that? Because, you know, at that point, the practitioner must see that he himself is free, that he himself is idea, that he himself is principle's idea, that he himself does not accuse himself. That's so important. And you see so often that people say, as a student say, you know, I don't have much difficulty in helping others, but I have a lot of difficulty in helping me, in healing me. And I feel if you feel that, that's always a sign that you cannot win your own pardon, that is lacking. Actually, it should be much easier to heal oneself than the other. Because with oneself, one knows what one is establishing in consciousness, and one is receptive for that very fact. Whereas with a patient, you don't know quite if he is receptive, if he resists it, if inwardly he has fear, and so on. Oneself, one can analyze much better and correct it. But why it is difficult is this very point, that students have difficulty in seeing themselves, oneself, as being free, standing free before principle. To be whole before the throne of God. To win one's own pardon. It's, you know, the old religious sense hangs on us and says, well, you can't win the pardon. You have done something wrong. And everybody has done something wrong. Everybody has not quite lived up to the mark. Everybody does that. And everybody can analyze and diagnose himself and say, you could have done better. And to win that pardon, that we see, really, that it is only mortal mind that can do anything wrong, and not we. That we only have been used by mortal mind, but not by our true identity. That our true identity was always right before God. And that's meaning our part, to see that animal magnetism is always the culprit, and not we, not the person. And if we see that, we can also see that in the patient, and not say, well, actually, you know, after all, you have done that, and now you jolly well have to get it back. But if we win our pardon, we can also pardon the Magdalene. If we cannot win our pardon, we will just deal with the patient the same way. What we have in our consciousness will be in our consciousness, no matter if it has to do with the patient or with us. It's still our consciousness. Therefore, that important point to win one's own pardon constantly, just not to let oneself be dragged down because one has been fooled by animal magnetism, because one has been an instrument and a tool of animal magnetism, because mortal mind has had a good joke with us. Win your own pardon and see that we are principle in practice, that we are the idea that is practiced by principle and not by mortal mind. Then we win our own pardon. We come to life, and in life we see how can we have perfection and a mentality of perfection from the point of view of life. Then when we have a mentality of fullness, the fullness of life, where we just see that we have a fullness in ourselves and not a mental penury within ourselves, where we have a sense we are a well of life, we are a source of life, out of us can flow uninterruptedly, inexhaustibly, the facts of being. So he also says we must first cast out moral evils out of ourselves. How? Through that fullness of life within ourselves. And to see, so to say, us as standing under that Niagara fall where the blessing of God just pours down on us and we can't quite fathom what we get. There is more coming to us than we can receive, and so we get the sense of the abundance of life, the redundant flow of life, the fullness of life, and only if we have a fullness of life for ourselves, we also can pour it out on the others and not feel, well, I have told him that. Why didn't he get it? Why didn't he take it? It's the penury, the mental penury. You say penury? Yeah. Instead of seeing God also gives out and gives out to us, and we only accept here a little and there a little. So let's have that sense that the fullness of life just overfloods the whole, the patient, and that we can work out of that great well of life.